Are you ready to become a better version of yourself, to become a leader in your personal and professional life? Then welcome to the CJ Evolution Podcast, where we put a twist on traditional criminal justice professions and provide you with the tools you need to set yourself up for success in your career and for the future. Now welcome your host, the CJ Evolutionist himself, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 223. Of CJ Evolution. Patrick here. I'm the host and creator of this great and growing show for the criminal justice professional like you, hosted by me, another criminal justice professional. And speaking of that, special thanks and a big shout out to all of you brave men and women working in the CJ field, protecting us day in and day out in a very difficult environment. You have much support. Keep up the fantastic work. I want to give a big shout out to our partner for this podcast, and that would be Four Sigmatic. They make great coffee along with other elixirs and cocoa products. And you can head over to cjevolution.com and you can get 15% off using the promo code CJEBO. You know, I think we all love stories that inspire us, that motivate us, especially from people that have really been through hell and back, that have been through some personal tragedies throughout their life. And a lot of my guests that have come on have been through that, but they've just kept the ball rolling. They had great mentors. They had great people around them pushing them to success. My next guest, you're going to love. Again, personal tragedy in his life, and he's going to talk about it. And now he's helping change some of the biggest problems we have in the criminal justice system. So I hope you enjoy this very inspirational and motivational guest. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have Christopher Poulos on the show. He is an attorney, and he does a lot with reentry. And I'm going to let him explain exactly what he does. Chris, are you there, sir?
I am. Thank you very much, Patrick, for having this podcast, for your service, and for inviting me as a guest.
Well, I appreciate you being here, sir. I know you're very, very busy. I probably didn't do you justice with that bio I just gave of you. Would you like to elaborate on that a little?
Sure. So, as Patrick said, I'm an attorney. I currently serve as executive director of the statewide Reentry Council in Washington, which was created by the Washington State Legislature in order to advise the governor and advise the legislature on what is working around reentry in the state, reentry from incarceration, what could be improved, and to help build relationships between all the different stakeholders that surround the area of incarceration and reentry.
And it's such an important you're doing such important work. I know you know that, Chris. And I think as law enforcement and criminal justice professionals, I think most of us, at least I hope that most of us realize is that the recidivism rates are very high in this country. And I think we need to be doing more, like we talked about a little bit before we started. We need to be doing more for the people coming out who are incarcerated as far as programs. I don't know what it's going to take. You're much more well-versed in this than I am. What it's going to take to lower those recidivism rates, but we need to be focusing on this a lot more. Correct?
Absolutely. So right now, there's some states that have as many as 7 out of 10 people being released from prisons, returning to prisons within about 3 to 5 years. In Washington State, it's only about 1 out of 3 returning within 3 years, but if you use any other kind of milestone for that, it's awful. So the thing I like to say is, imagine if 1 out of every 3 cars that went out on the highway ended up in a tragic accident, right? We would just pause everything, or 1 out of every 3 planes. Mm-hmm. So we are hoping we can realize that 1 out of 3 people not succeeding after correctional intervention is a major issue. Mm. And we're working to change what goes on inside prisons, so that people aren't simply warehoused, so that people are learning the skills mm-hmm. necessary to succeed, while also truly addressing any underlying issues that may be present, or actually almost always present,
yeah,
that lead to the decisions that result ultimately in incarceration or even death.
Yeah. And some people don't realize this, Chris. I mean, I know you do. But some people think, and I've talked to people that have this mindset, usually they're not inside the criminal justice system, but they think, well, somebody goes off to prison, they're gone forever. No, the majority of people are going to get out of prison at some point. So we need to be doing what we can to, like you said, make them productive members of society through education or programs or whatever. I want to digress a little bit, if you don't mind, Chris. And you have a very powerful background. Your personal story. Can you tell the listener about that?
Sure. So the reason I got involved in this type of work stems from my own personal experiences, both with addiction, with other mental health conditions, and ultimately with going through the court system several times and for various misdemeanor charges and during an untreated active addiction to drugs and alcohol, mm-hmm. and then ultimately resulting in a federal incarceration for a first-time, relatively low-level nonviolent drug offense. Mm-hmm. And it was what happened in my life was I ended up getting sober before I was indicted on the federal charges. And so I went in to the prison with a certain degree of awareness, mm-hmm. and some recovery under my belt, and started for the first time in my life in prison, really, was being drawn toward people on a positive path, even within the prison, mm-hmm. as opposed to my whole life. I think probably everyone goes through a rebellious phase, right?
Sure,
you know,
sure, 13 sure.
years old, 15 years old. I just really went through quite the rebellious phase, but I didn't realize that much of that was due to unresolved trauma from growing up and active substance use disorder, active addiction, mm-hmm. and so once those underlying issues were treated, I magically stopped committing felonies on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Right, there was amazing the strong correlation there. Mm-hmm. Long story short, I grew up in Portland, Maine, and my mom was a single mom. I had in some ways had a lot of privileges growing up. In other ways, I had a lot of challenges, mm-hmm. and found myself seeking people who were not making healthy decisions as my friends. And immediately, as an early teenager, even pre-teenager, falling into prescription drug use, alcohol use, other drug use. And as is very common, by my early 20s, that had escalated to periods of homelessness, gone to jail, gone to mental hospitals. And ultimately, like I said, about 6 months into my recovery, I got sober, and then I was indicted on federal charges.
Yeah. And I know you talk about this in your story because I read this, that you had some important people in your life, some good mentors that you leaned on, correct, to help you through those darkest times in your life.
Definitely. There's been so many people who have helped me out. I think, one thing that I think is important for listeners to this show, because I think there'll be some law enforcement listening, mm-hmm. is – I did not, what would have been great is if one of the prosecutors, one of the defense attorneys, one of the judges had sat down with me and just said, what are you doing? What do you want your life to be like? Is there something we can do to change this path? Mm-hmm. Because what was happening was I'd get arrested, get a summons to go to court, but there was never any type of structured intervention at all. It was just, here's your court date, here's your 2 days in jail.
Yeah.
Be good.
Yeah, and I like what you said when I was reading about your story, Chris, is that, you'd get, and the prosecutor or your defense attorney, I'm sorry, would say, all right, are you ready to plead guilty? And when they didn't even, you said in some cases, you didn't even get to see, or your attorney didn't even get to see the evidence. Now, I know that, plea bargaining is a common practice, as do you, but in some of these cases, you made a really good point that the push was to take a plea right away.
Right. Yeah. It felt like it has felt when I've been a defendant and some of the cases I've witnessed and even been a part of representing youth facing criminal charges, it felt like a conveyor belt. Mm-hmm. It felt like I was in, everybody was part of this machine where it was just headed off toward whatever the result is going to be. Maybe it's jail, maybe it's prison, maybe it's a fine and community service, but it didn't. My understanding is that the court system, and especially criminal law, is intended to be an adversarial system where sure. you've got a prosecutor on one side and you've got defense counsel on the other, mm-hmm. and these two are not meant to be immediately entering into basically contracts law without any type of back and forth, really.
Sure.
And then the judge or the jury is supposed to be the fact finder.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my vision of what the criminal justice system could look like. But the reason I bring up the court system is because I actually did have one officer who I was going to jail for drinking and driving. I was, I think, 21 on the dot. And he was the high school resource officer from my high school. And he transported me. He didn't have anything to do with my arrest or anything, but he transported me to jail after. And he actually said, you know, you're still young. You've got a chance. Who are you? Why are you hanging out with these people that are going to just, you're going to get in more and more trouble? You know, couldn't you think about doing something different? And I got to tell you, I wasn't ready that night to change, but I still remember that conversation and the impact yeah. that officer had on me to yeah. this day.
Yeah.
And you know, two or three years later, I did.
Yeah.
You know, I did. I made the change.
Yeah. And it resonated with you, which is important.
What a yeah, way to make an impact.
Yeah, yeah. And if you don't mind, Chris, I want you in reading and doing some research on you, you talk about the collateral consequences of criminal records and how reducing these barriers can increase public safety. Can you explain that?
Sure. So once someone's sentence is done, the idea, at least in theory, with some rare exceptions, mm-hmm. but or some narrow exceptions, I should say, probably not rare, but generally speaking, the judge will say, okay, so you're getting 2 years in prison, a fine of $2,000, and a year of probation, right? That's the sentence. And to me, that, you know, whether it's just or not, what that's a separate conversation. But once someone has paid their debt to society and completed their sentence, it's essential for public safety. Even, you know, putting aside values of redemption and rehabilitation and second chances and kind of like basic tenets of Christianity and other faiths.
Sure.
But just the fact that if what happens is once someone's sentence is done, there are still so many barriers in place, especially if you get the label, you know, you have to check yes for felony conviction on anything, or disclose that, or and sometimes it'll even ask applications will ask about arrests, or misdemeanor convictions or felony convictions. And this could be everything from employment to housing to volunteering at your children's school, to, you know, it's a myriad of things, to public benefits such as food assistance. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's just a perfect example of backward policy. So someone's got a drug conviction, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can't get aid for food when they come home. What's that going to do? What's the person going to do if they can't eat?
Yeah.
You think they're going to say, you know what, I'm just going to slowly starve?
Mm-hmm.
Of course not. They're going to revert to criminal behavior.
That's a good point, yeah.
So a lot of the barriers that are put in place, at least with the idea of public safety, are actually detrimental to public safety.
Now, the opposite to that is you could have people that would say, what do you do with the people that are, you know, incarcerated for you know, like sex assault and things like that, or sex assault on children? I mean, would you advocate the same policy, is the question? Because I could hear the opposite side to this.
So I think that every policy, most policies will have some certain public safety exceptions.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So we passed in the most recent legislative session Fair Chance law for employment. So basically ban the box about on applications. Now, any public safety agencies are exempt from that, because if there's policies where the person's just definitely going to be disqualified later down the line anyway, then why waste anyone's time or get anyone's hopes up?
Mm-hmm.
But if it's discretionary, and most, I think even a lot of departments are now, they're kind of discretionary, right? They'll look at the facts. You know, okay, you smoked pot 2 years ago. All right, that's okay. But you did heroin yesterday? Okay.
You're probably
not going to be the best fit for the academy tomorrow, you know? Yeah. Let's talk in a couple of years if you've got some recovery or something like that. So what we do is when we develop these policies, we try to make them fair to everyone. And so you can think of examples of people where it might not be the best fit for someone who has a conviction for X to be working at Y.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Whereas, say somebody does have a sexual related conviction and they want to work at a warehouse stacking boxes at night, but they're still immediately disqualified as soon as they check yes on
yeah.
the box.
Yeah, I get where you're going, and yeah. I get that. That's a good point.
So I really think that, you know, having some discretion there and looking at individuals as individuals instead of categorically is what we're really looking for.
You probably know this, Chris, and I know the listeners, most of the listeners do. You know, law enforcement is going, I know my agency in particular, I can only speak for my agency, but looking at the data and the information that's out there, law enforcement's responding to a lot more calls with people who are suffering from mental health issues. You know, you talked about your addiction issues, and what's the connection between substance abuse, in your opinion, and mental health conditions? Because I got to tell you, man, you know the opiate crisis that's going on in this country. You talk about prescription medication, and it's all can be connected, correct?
Absolutely. I think that it's just such a strong connection with legal system involvement and, you know, mental health conditions, substance use disorder, and poverty, and especially when you wrap them all together, it's just a recipe for legal system involvement generally and, you know, criminal justice involvement specifically. And so it's an ongoing issue. I think that, you know, part of how we got into this was a lot of the state institutions were closed decades ago, and so people who normally would be with the best intentions, they were thinking, you know, people don't need to be in institutions indefinitely if they're not danger.
Sure.
What happened was nothing was built, right? Communities, as far as, you know, enough group homes and stuff like that. So we have now large mentally ill homeless populations.
Yeah.
And then with drug addiction, and alcohol use too, is I can tell you every single one of my clients when I represented teenagers facing criminal charges, every single one had substances involved in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Some way. They either were being charged with something directly related to a substance, or they were under the influence of a substance, or they had been robbed of a substance, right? And they're trying to get money back. It was just almost invariably.
Yeah.
Even when you get something like a white collar offense, oftentimes if you dig a little deeper, you'll find out this person was hooked on gambling or they were, you know what I mean? So I always try to look to the core. And to me, it's not about being, I mean, I think it is about being compassionate, but it's not about being somehow soft on crime. It's about being effective.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Right. If we don't address these underlying issues through treatment, through peer-to-peer support, et cetera, then they're just going to repeat as we see over and over again.
And I think some of the, you mentioned, you know, state institutions, I would agree with that. And you know this too, Chris, and the listener probably, maybe they don't. But, you know, it just seems like we've gotten to a point, and this isn't an indictment on all the pharmaceutical companies out there, but I think some of them, and you know, the research is out, I mean, they're just so quickly to prescribe, you know, narcotics. And doctors are, some doctors, not all, are so quick to subscribe, you know, all these opiates to people all the time. You know what I mean? I mean, I think that's part of it too. I mean, there's many dynamics to this. I mean, there's just not one quick, you know, point the finger and say that's the main problem. But I definitely think that's an issue.
It is. I mean, there's a balance, right? Because some people who are in severe chronic pain and have serious illnesses absolutely need compassion and strong medication. But there was a systemic marketing campaign in favor of opioids, in favor of amphetamine for, you know, children and teenagers, for ADHD, all sorts of Schedule II highly addictive substances that I don't even think you can argue, really, that marijuana is more dangerous as far as lethality.
No, I don't think that's an argument anymore.
The doctors are handing out.
Yeah.
Not to say that marijuana doesn't have its own consequences.
Sure.
Different ballgame than fentanyl.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, if law enforcement was somehow directed to actually enforce, really spend some time looking at that at a major level, which DOJ recently did, actually. I saw that under Jeff Sessions, did some real made some strides in that area, going after some of the marketing techniques and stuff that had been used, which contributed to this. So without going into politics or anything like that, I have to say I agree with that. And, you know, a supply reduction alone focused approach to drug control it's just never worked. We've been trying it for 150 years, literally, since even alcohol prohibition and before.
Well, it's supply and demand. You know, it's supply and demand. And you know, there needs to be a lot more work done. I think we're just scratching the surface, and it helps by having, you know, conversations like these. Can you talk about the sentencingproject.org that you're involved in?
Sure. So I did an internship with them back when I was in D.C. before I did my internship at the White House in the most recent administration. But it was during, I did it as a law school legal fellow, so I got to actually really, you know, work on the substantive projects there at the Sentencing Project. And they look at the impact of incarceration. They look at disparities around race and economics and gender and all these different things, and then, actually study the data and then make recommendations as far as advocacy and legal changes go. So, you know, one of the major takeaways I had from that experience is that a lot of people think about, you know, we, as I'm sure you know, we incarcerate more people in this country than any other nation. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, 2.2, 2.3 million people are actually in jails and prisons, and then millions of more are under some form of correctional control. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it baffles me. It's, with our motto, Land of the Free, it's like, I mean, I think that's, we should aspire to be the land of the free. We've besides some maybe World War II, but that wasn't correctional control. Besides that, no other nation has actually incarcerated as many people as we do.
Yeah.
And so the question that, you know, the Sentencing Project asks and we hope to answer is, you know, how did we get here, and how can we decarcerate without compromising public safety, right?
Yeah.
And so, to me, you know, one of the big takeaways I got, everybody thinks it's the war on drugs is what led to huge increases in incarceration. And that is a partial correct answer. But the biggest driver for incarceration is more, changes in enforcement and changes in sentence length.
Yeah.
There's one factor that created the biggest level of incarceration was, if you robbed a bank with a buddy in 1970, you'd probably have to go to prison for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. You know, you do the same thing in 1984, you're getting 30 years. And so that's really what happened, is the change in sentencing.
Yeah.
And so that's been studied, and it shows that there actually was a, you know, decrease in violent crime and other types of crime for a while from some of the changes.
Mm-hmm.
But then it reached a point where it kind of went over the top and actually started to be detrimental to communities and to people. Like, you know, the classic example is the crack law enforcement, right? Where crack used to be 100 times the penalty. 100. It still baffles me. I've been talking about this for years. But you have 1 gram of powder cocaine is the same as, I mean, excuse me, 1 gram of crack cocaine is the same as having 100 grams of powder cocaine. So mm-hmm. the penalty is that much greater. And that just led to, you know, large numbers of people being incarcerated who are really at the low end. And from working, from literally everything from, you know, my experience of actually using and selling drugs during my addiction to working on drug policy within the executive office of the president, shows me that, you know, most of the people, I hate to say it, we don't have a whole lot of Don Corleones and Scarfaces.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
It's Bobby who got caught with an ounce of meth.
Yeah.
You know, that's who. And so it's looking at that sentencing and saying, what really makes sense? How can we have accountability without warehousing people? How do we, you know, to me, it's what does accountability look like? Yeah. Is it really helping to warehouse somebody for 20 years who was bringing some stuff across state lines to support their habit or whatever?
Yeah. And there's a financial component to this, a huge financial component, as you're well aware. You know, it's a lot of money to incarcerate people. Now, I think some people need to be in prison, but like you said, I mean, some people probably don't need to be in prison for long periods of time, and this is all a financial consequence to the taxpayer.
It is. So it's and that's an issue too, because it's costing taxpayers a ton of money, but there's also a lot of people who have a vested interest it continuing, and you know, everybody will look to, you know, private prisons, right, who are, you know, are actually making money off of incarceration and off of people, you know, being separated from their families and put in prison. And that is definitely, you know, a concern. But the bigger barrier, I think, than the private prison lobby is just there's a lot of people, regular, everyday people whose jobs depend on mass incarceration at this
point.
Yeah. These aren't evil people, right? It's, you know, the nurses in the prisons, the COs, the contractors, the people who make the 2 million pillows. So all of that and any of these efforts were going to the anything that's going to decrease beds that are filled in any facility, whether it's right or wrong, it's going to have resistance because people have their livelihoods.
Sure. That's a great point. I would encourage people to go over to sentencingproject.org, and I'll have that linked up to the show notes. A lot of great data, very comprehensive. I was really impressed when I went on there, and you could see, like Chris said, the disparity in incarceration rates and all these different all this great information. So I'll have that linked up. And I know you gave a TED talk. I'm going to do a plug. You gave a TED talk. I haven't had a chance to watch it on reentry and your personal journey in 2015, correct, Chris?
I did, yes, back home in Maine. And I can tell you something funny about that, which I couldn't talk about at the time, was I was actually working, I was interning at the White House at the Office of National Drug Control Policy when I gave that TED Talk.
Uh-huh.
But I wasn't allowed to say that during the talk because, you know, the White House is concerned about, you know, anyone who works there, if you're speaking publicly, it could be viewed as you're speaking for the administration.
Obviously,
as a law student intern and not a director of an agency or the president, it wasn't, they weren't wanting me to do that. And I think that was kind of just annoying, but the exciting part of that was another thing was because of the component I was in, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, it's a sensitive component. So you had to have national security position clearance to be there. And they're not, you don't necessarily want everyone on this earth to know who is there and who is not for safety and security and intelligence reasons. So it was cool. I mean, for me, that was so cool to think, wow, I'm not just like putting along after being incarcerated, right? I'm actually truly being treated as if I am redeemed. I was welcomed in and trusted, and I made sure to behave in my position in a way that you know, aligned with that trust that I was given.
Yeah, and I think your story is amazing. I mean, I'm sure you get a lot of that when you're out and about and people hear your story, because there is. I know some people out there, and you know this, Chris. I don't think there's very few families out there, in today's world that I don't think are affected in some way, shape, or form by some form of addiction. I mean, maybe there are, but I think a lot of family. I know me personally, I am with a family member, and so I think you're an inspiration for people out there that do struggle with addictions, and you're still in recovery, like you said. But I mean, you're an inspiration, man. I mean, you've gone from where you were at. I'm sure you think about this a lot. Or, I used to be homeless and I used to be struggling, and now look where I'm at. You know,
right.
It truly is amazing. And like I said, I truly admire you. And how far you've come. And really quick before we wrap up, I know we were talking about this before we went live, Chris, and it was something that you said at the beginning of the show about how that officer, just in the very short period of time, you were sitting in the back of a patrol car and he was giving you some food for thought. I want you to talk a little bit about how important it is between law, I mean, just transforming those relations between law enforcement and the public, because I think it's very important.
Absolutely. So I agree. It's definitely important. It's vital. If we see each other as, you know, enemies inherently, because one person wears this hat and another person is perceived as wearing a different type of hat or role in society, then it's just a constant state of conflict with very little room for transformation or for healing.
Yeah.
One of the things we're working on is we're hoping that in DOC here in Washington, Department of Corrections, so as my role as Reentry Counsel ED, mm-hmm. we're hoping we get to a point where when somebody enters a prison at DOC right in the beginning of their sentence, that a DOC employee will actually sit down with them and not just assign a job and a housing unit, but actually really have a full conversation and develop some goals and develop a vision, like really do some motivational interviewing, like what would you be doing if you weren't here, or what would you be doing, what would you like to do after 10 years?
Yeah.
And maybe the person doesn't know, but I think we can help a person either see that again, who may have lost their vision and their purpose, their feeling of purpose. And what a conversation like that can do is, of course, it's going to help the person who's, you know, being asked the questions, right? The person who's incarcerated. But who else do you think that's going to help?
Yeah.
The person asking the questions,
yeah.
right? That correctional officer now has skin in the game,
mm-hmm.
because they're starting to build a relationship. And I don't see any, to me, that's going to increase institutional security, because if somebody has a belief in their future, the chances of them getting involved in anything inside the facility that'll jeopardize that are dramatically decreased.
Yep.
So I think it's possible to change. It is possible. I've been part of it, to change relationships between law enforcement and between people who are, maybe actively or who have broken the laws in the past, because there's some major change and progress that can happen when that willingness is there.
Yeah, and what's the downside? There is none. There is no downside.
And it's free.
Yeah, and it's free. Well, Chris Poulos, thank you so much, sir. Keep doing an amazing job. Keep doing amazing work. I will have reentryprogram.org linked up in the show notes, as well as your TED Talk, sir. And if people want to reach out to you, how can they find you, Chris?
The website is actually commerce.wa.gov /reentry.
Okay.
And I can be reached, my email is on there. The easiest way to reach me is email. And it's right on the website, commerce.wa.gov/reentry.
Well, Chris Poulos, thank you so much, sir. Much success to you in the future. And thank you for coming on the show.
Of course. Thank you, Patrick.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns.
We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.